Just as Lord Krishna forcibly pushed Kali's large energy in the form of irresistible time kills all conditioned souls and thus forces them down there. Arrowhead heads. We should therefore give up the artificial position of material life and become faithful servants of the Supreme Lord, enthusiastically bowing down to his lotus feet. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that Lord Krishna's lotus feet became red like copper because of their contact with the numerous hard jewels on the heads of Kaliya. Lord Krishna, with whose glowing reddish, with those glowing reddish feet, then began to demonstrate his artistic skill by dancing on the unsteady moving surface of the serpent's hooves. This extraordinary demonstration of dancing skill was meant for the pleasure of the young women of Vrindavan, but this phase of their relationship with Krishna were seriously falling in love with him. Translation: having severely depleted the serpent's strength with his relentless circling, Sri Krishna, the origin of everything, pushed down Kaliya's raised shoulders and mounted his broad serpentine heads. Thus, Lord Sri Krishna, the original master of all fine arts, began to dance, so to speak, deeply reddened by the touch of the numerous jewels upon the serpent's heads. Still, after Krishna was tightly bound up in the coils of the serpent for some time, and then all of the Brajavasis found him there by following his footprints, and then they saw him in the clutches of the serpent and began fainting and crying and going through various types of distress. Nanda Maharaj wanted to jump in there and try to fight Kaliya along with the cowherd men, and Mother Yasoda was crying and fainting. Krishna decided he would become active again. So he escaped from Kaliya and began swimming around him and harassing him in different ways. And then he jumped on his heads and began dancing. So this verse is interesting because it describes Krishna here as the Adya, as we say Adi, one who is the origin of everything, the supreme source. So first of all, Krishna was circling around Kaliya. Though we should think that everybody else circles around Krishna, just as the planets circle around the sun, etc. And Krishna is Adya, he's the origin of everything. So everything should revolve around the Supreme Lord. But here we have Krishna circling around Kaliya, as if he is less powerful and whatnot, and Kaliya is very, very powerful. So this, of course, is probably very good for Kaliya, that he thinks I'm the center of everything. Krishna is some small creature here trying to bite me. Previously mentioned that Krishna also is playing with Kaliya. He doesn't seriously have to do anything, but he likes to prolong the fight sometimes and give a little courage to the asuras so they can fight better. So in this way he was acting as if he's lesser than Kaliya. But he is the origin. So therefore, we see here that Kaliya is described here, that Kaliya had raised shoulders. He was up high. And of course this indicates pride. One who's proud has raised shoulders and raised head, etc. So Kaliya had all his hooves raised up and everything, thinking he was very powerful. But because Krishna is the origin of everything, then Krishna could actually jump upon his heads without any problem. In other words, Krishna showed that he was superior to Kaliya by climbing on top of him. So physically, at least, he was higher up in that sense, by standing on his head. And this, of course, indicates something, because when we bow down in the temple room, we are bowing down our heads and touching the lotus feet of Krishna. So Krishna is dancing on our head. But that's voluntary. So in devotional service, we accept the role of being subservient to Krishna. We are the servant of Krishna. And whatever Krishna wants, he can do. And so that is what is indicated when we bow down. We are giving up all of our struggle and our power and our ego and everything, putting ourselves in a very humble role. And Krishna, of course, doesn't exploit those jivas who surrender. He rather gives them great mercy. And he's very, very moved by the efforts of the jivas who surrender to him. So he gives them bliss. So that is voluntary surrender. Kali, of course, isn't going to voluntarily surrender. He is a demon. So Krishna jumps on his shoulders and jumps on his head. Without Kaliya bowing down, actually, Krishna jumped on his hands. So this is involuntary surrender, we can say. Just as Krishna kills all the demons and then they have to surrender because they have to give up their life. So that's automatic surrender because of death. In this case, we see that Krishna did not kill Kali, which is also great mercy. He could have, without any effort, because it's not that Kali was a lesser demon than Putana or any of the others. Certainly, Kali is also trying to kill Krishna. He's holding him in his coils, trying to poison him, etc. Yet, Krishna shows some remarkable mercy here. He kills the other demons, but he does not kill Kali in the end. He actually lets him go. But at the same time, what happens here is actually Krishna makes him humble. He converts, in other words. He's very, very proud. And after Krishna jumps on his head and dances on his head, and finally, with the pleading of the wives of Kaliya, then Kaliya becomes a little humble and apologizes. So Krishna doesn't kill him. He's not a hopeless case. But here he is, actually. So by Krishna's mercy, actually, he was able to become delivered and still remain alive in this body, even though he was a big asura and offender to the Lord because he attacked the Lord, etc. He's a big offender. And he shouldn't live. But yet Krishna is all-merciful, and he lets him survive. And he actually becomes subservient to the Lord, performs some devotional service. So in this way, Krishna jumped on his hoods. And then he began to dance. Of course, he can just, many ways Krishna can conquer over Kaliya. He can wrestle with him, he can strangle him, or whatever. Or he can jump on his head and break his skull or whatever. Whatever he wants, he can do. In this case, Krishna didn't even do that. He danced. So this performed two functions. When Krishna danced on Kaliya's head, it was very attractive to the Rajavasis and particularly the young gopis. This is before the Rasalila, actually. Before that time. After this comes also stories like stealing the gopis' clothes and all this. And then we have finally a Rasalila in chapter 25. So this is before that. Much before that. But yet the Krishna was growing up, and the young gopis were also growing up. So gradually their attraction began to manifest. The year before the Rasalila, their attraction for Krishna began to manifest. And Krishna's attraction for the gopis began to manifest a little early. So one function of this, one purpose of this dancing on Kaliya's head is to display his skill before the gopis. And just as young men like to display themselves before young women and attract them in some way. So Krishna is attracting the young men by his skillful dancing. Or as the peacock dances. Dances and attracts the female peacock, the peahen. So Krishna displays his skills. Because Krishna is the Supreme Lord, he's endowed with all powers and all qualities and all skills and all arts. And this is described in his 64 qualities. He is very skillful in the arts. He's skillful in language. He can speak all languages, even animal languages. He's skillful in poetry and composing things like this. He's very skillful at expressing himself in joking ways. He's skillful at making puns and, you know, all these things with everyone. He makes double language like that. And he's skillful in painting. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. He's in endowed with all powers and all qualities and all skills and all arts. And this is described in his 64 qualities. He is very skillful in the arts. He's skillful in language. He can speak all languages, even animal languages. He's skillful in poetry and composing things like this. He's very skillful at expressing himself in joking ways. He's skillful at making puns and, you know, all these things with everyone. He makes double language like that. And he's skillful in painting and drawing and mineralogy and all sorts of sciences like that. And skillful in making things. He can make decorations and flower ornaments and all sorts of things like that, and wonderful things, houses, etc. And he can also dance. Of course, he plays the flute very well also. Very good musician, and he plays the flute. And he's a very, very good dancer. In fact, he's very famous for his dancing. Huh? So he's called Natavara, the best of the dancers. So this is one of his features. Now that dancing, he particularly displays to the gopis. And we see that in the Rasa, the place Rasa Lila is a dance. It's a special dance in a circle, actually. And there's special, you know, movements of the feet, movements of the hand mudras, and then like in Bharatanatyam, they have all the different positions which mean things. So there's all sorts of footsteps, there's different footsteps that are going with different rhythms, etc. And then you have to express your facial expressions also go with that, with your eyes, moving your eyes and your mouth, whatever. Move your face around and make expressions on your face according to the leelas and the story you're depicting in the song. So there's a lot of skill involved in this, and you have to coordinate all your movements and do this for a long time. And of course that was perfected in the Rasa Leela itself, where Krishna and 3 billion gopis all danced. And Krishna was in 3 billion forms, dancing with all the gopis. And each thought, Krishna's only with me. And they went on and on and on, dancing in different ways and singing in different ways like this, showing their skill. And sometimes someone would do a solo like this, and Krishna would do a solo, some gopi would do a solo, some would be dancing and singing at the same time. And they would show all these different movements and were skillful with the rhythm and the song, etc. All sorts of movements. So Krishna was most expert at doing this. And he could attract everybody with his dancing there. So he's a very wonderful dancer. So before that, he's also showing his skill here. But it's a little different because here he's dancing on top of a demon. He's a little dangerous in most cases. But he's very skillful anyway. In spite of the fact that he's doing it on the hooves of a demon, he's got all these little sharp jewels on his head. Krishna can dance very, very artfully on top of the demon's head. The heads are moving up and down like this, and Krishna's jumping around and dancing at the same time. And it's very attractive to particularly the gopis. Everybody sees it, all the Brajavasis see it, but particularly the gopis become very attracted to that. So this is one reason why he dances like this on the head instead of just pushing his, knocking his head in or whatever. So he attracts the gopis by this. And of course, his dancing is also, apart from the gopis in conjugal rasa, all of his activities are very, very attractive to all of the people, whether it's his friends or his servants or his parents or the elder gopis and gopis. They're all attracted to everything that Krishna does. So Krishna dances very nicely. They're all very delighted with that. So it's a delight for everybody to see his skill in dancing, his artistic skills and grace and beauty. And the other point, of course, is that skillfully dancing, he also he defeats Kaliya by doing so. So he's also showing power at the same time as he shows his skill of dancing. Now, most of the time when one dances, it's more like artistic or something like that. And it's not a military art or something to kill anybody. But simultaneously, Krishna's doing both here. He's dancing very artistically. It's very pleasing, very beautiful. And at the same time, he's defeating Kaliya. So you can do two things at once. He can defeat the demon, and he can, at the same time, attract everybody with his beauty and his artistic skills. Yeah. So Krishna does this. And not only he defeats the demon, but in the process he makes the demon surrender. That's another thing. So it's good for the demon also, it doesn't kill him. But rather through this way he jumps on his hands, whatever. Finally, Kaliya submits to him. And he doesn't have to kill him at all.
So this is another purpose that he makes Kaliya surrender by this process. So dancing on the head of Kaliya, of course, is an insult to Kaliya, because for a kshatriya or a warrior to have to bow down to another person, another warrior, is very shameful. And just to get your top knot cut off, as Aswatthama got his cut off, yeah, like that, after he threw the brahmastra, that was very shameful. That's considered very, you know, degrading, to have to submit to another person. But to have someone jump on your head, it's most shameful. So, but Kaliya had to submit, he couldn't do anything. And then Krishna jumped on his head and he couldn't escape. No matter how Kaliya moved around in the water or shook his hands or whatever, Krishna was there jumping on his head. And he couldn't escape him in any way. So in this way, with Kaliya moving around and thrashing around and whatever, and Krishna jumping up and down on his head, all sorts of matter. Eventually, Kaliya could not bear it anymore. Even though Krishna's lotus feet are considered the most soft. And if he goes in the forest, Mother Yasoda worries that the grass will cut his feet, whatever. And the gopis also are worried that he'll cut his feet in the forest. So Krishna's feet are very soft, very tender. The body is very tender. Those feet are very soft. When they touch Kaliya, they are harder than thunderbolts. So simultaneously, they perform two functions, one for the devotees and one for the demons. So though they're very soft for the devotees, they're very hard for the demons. So this way, when Krishna dances on Kaliya, then it is very painful for Kaliya. He cannot tolerate it anymore and he gets defeated by this. So here it also says that Krishna's feet became tamra. Atitamra. Tamra, of course, means copper, actually. Technically, so reddish like copper. That's very reddish. At the same time, they're described as lotus feet, pada ambuja, feet which are like lotuses, which are very red. Now, naturally, Krishna's feet are red, and they're sometimes compared to red lotuses or pink lotuses or whatever. But then again, as Vishnu Chakravarti explains here, because of dancing on the on his rough surface, his tender feet, they became redder. Now, of course, another reason could be is that the jewels themselves were rubies, or red jewels, and therefore they reflected off the Krishna's feet and made them more intense red. So, of course, it's not really painful for Krishna because his feet are simultaneously harder than thunderbolts, so it doesn't really matter. But the red feet is considered to be a very, very attractive sign, having red feet. So that's why Krishna has lotus feet, redness on the bottom. And generally we paint his hands also red, as we see in Krishna there. So these are some of the marks of a great person, you know, wonderful symptoms in the body. He has red hands and red feet and red fingernails and whatever. Certain parts of his body are red, tips of his eyes are red also. So it's all considered very beautiful, outstanding characteristics. So if Krishna's feet are very, very red, they're very, very beautiful. So therefore, it's not to say his feet are copper, that doesn't mean they're ugly or things, they're very attractive. So, there are redness on the bottom, and generally we paint his hands also red, as we see in Krishna there. So these are some of the marks of a great person, you know, wonderful symptoms in the body. He has red hands and red feet and red fingernails and whatever. Certain parts of his body are red, tips of his eyes are red also. So it's all considered very beautiful, outstanding characteristics. So if Krishna's feet are very, very red, they're very, very beautiful. So therefore, it's not to say his feet are copper, that doesn't mean they're ugly or anything, but they're very attractive. So, therefore, even though he's fighting with Kaliya and defeating him, he becomes most attractive by his appearance, by his red feet, by his attractive movements of dancing, and by his heroism and strength in defeating Kaliya. So in this way, by one act, he accomplishes many, many things. He pleases the gopis and attracts them. He pleases, or he satisfies the inhabitants of Vrindavan that he's not dead. After all, he's very active, and he can conquer over the demon. And the gopas, his friends, are very, very satisfied because they see Krishna showing some strength and skill. Parents are relieved that Krishna's not dead after all, not squeezed up by Kaliya, and he can handle the situation. And the demon is benefited because he doesn't get killed, but he gets to become submissive. And finally, he offers prayers to Krishna because of the pleas of his wives. So this way, Krishna accomplishes many things by this particular pastime, and remains, at the same time, Krishna. So after all of this is over, again, the people of Vrindavan will see Krishna, and they will think of him not as God, but as their child. Again, he doesn't change his size at all. He's still a young boy, a very tender young boy, but somehow or other, by the grace of Vishnu, who protects him, he was able to defeat Kaliya. So this is how the inhabitants of Vrindavan think of Krishna when he does this. So the purport here is mentioned that the demons do not submit voluntarily, whereas the devotees submit voluntarily. In any case, the demons have to submit also. Everybody has to submit to the Lord because by nature he is supreme. By definition, God means supreme and independent. And everything else and everybody else is dependent. And that cannot be altered in any way. And so by very nature, everybody is dependent on the Supreme Lord in all ways. So those who voluntarily accept this fact, and when they accept this fact, then they don't show any hostility towards the Lord, but they develop a relationship of love with the Lord, those people are called Vaishnavas. And the Lord is very joyful to accept all of these people. Those who are the demons refuse to accept the superiority of anybody, even though by nature they are dependent on the Supreme Lord. And they will say no, even if you call Vishnu or even. And when they accept this fact, that they don't show any hostility towards the Lord, but they develop a relationship of love with the Lord, those people are called Vaishnavas. And the Lord is very joyful to accept all of these people. Those who are the demons refuse to accept the superiority of anybody, even though by nature they are dependent on the Supreme Lord. And they will say no, even if you call Vishnu, or even if you're Krishna, or even if you're God, we don't care what that is. We are independent of you. So in other words, they don't accept the idea of God at all. So, for those people, how does Krishna control them? He doesn't control them in the normal way because he doesn't interfere with their free will. He doesn't just simply throw them all in jail in a normal way and punish them immediately. He lets them use their free will. So by that we will think maybe Krishna is not so powerful because we see the demons doing all sorts of bad things, then he doesn't stop them. So he lets them use their free will, but nevertheless, he puts limitations on all of these living entities also. So one way is through the law of karma. All of their activities will bind them to certain reactions, and if they do sinful activities, they get painful reactions for that. So this is one way in which the demons become limited, in spite of the fact that they don't recognize the Lord. Another way, of course, is the very nature of the limitations on all of these living entities also. So one way is through the law of karma. All of their activities will bind them to certain reactions, and if they do sinful activities, they get painful reactions for that. So this is one way in which the demons become limited, in spite of the fact that they don't recognize the Lord. Another way, of course, is the very nature of the material body of these demons, by nature, it is temporary. All material forms are temporary. So the demons accept material forms, and then those forms must die eventually. They're impermanent. They will get sick, they will die, they will get wounded, etc. Okay? So there's automatically problems for the demons and those who do not recognize the Lord. So all of the persons who do not submit voluntarily to the Lord, they will have to undergo these problems anyway by force. So this is by the will of the Lord, by the rules of karma, by the rules of material nature. They have to suffer this. So in that way, they are bowing down. They don't know it, but this is how, because the laws, they cannot break the laws. They cannot escape the laws of karma. They cannot escape the laws of material nature, which cause destruction. They cannot escape. So this is the control that the Lord puts on them, in spite of the fact that they don't want to admit existence of higher powers. So that is why it is sometimes said that for the demons, the Lord comes in the form of death. That they have to accept. They cannot escape that. And so death is superior to them, because they cannot counteract death. So in that way, they get a realization, oh, death is more powerful than me. So then death is God. So death and time, Kala, which creates temporary things in death, that is, Krishna says, I am Kala, I am that time, destructive material nature. So this is how the Lord treats those who are demons in the world. The force of time and death automatically make them submissive. In spite of that, in spite of being submissive, they don't submit. And they take another birth and they go through the whole process again. Because they're very stubborn and very ignorant. So unfortunately, it's not just demons, it's all living entities are like that. And therefore we sit in the material world birth after birth after birth. And the lower living entities don't have enough consciousness to realize this, but yet they're going through this process automatically. Human beings have the intelligence to realize it, but most of them don't. 99% don't. So this is the unfortunate position of people in the material world. Though they have the ability to understand that they are not independent and supreme, most of the living entities are too lazy to think about it and realize it. So the Lord helps us by giving scriptures, and through the scriptures we get a clue to the nature of material existence, and the nature of spiritual world, Jiva, Supreme Lord, etc. By this, then we get some glimpse of the truth. And by the association of devotees, then we get that knowledge, and then we can begin developing. Once we get the seed of that knowledge, then we can begin to think about it, etc. But the what is the source of that? Only if we have faith, we'll take that knowledge. So when we have a little favorableness towards the Supreme Lord, the existence of the Supreme Lord, then we can accept the scripture and develop from there. So once that faith is there, then the process of getting out of illusion, getting out of the material world, attaining the lotus feet of the Lord, becomes a quicker process. Before that, it is a hopeless process. You can go here for billions of lifetimes and nothing will happen. Once you get the faith, then it becomes quick. Before that, it's useless. So, therefore, if one happens to get devotional service, and not only get devotional service, but get an understanding of Krishna and getting the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, then that is even more rare, more wonderful, more fortunate. So we should take advantage of what mercy Krishna and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given to us. And try to advance and reach higher and higher levels until we have pure devotion.
Well, sometimes when we are preaching to someone, we understand that that person doesn't have a faith, so he's not able to accept certain things. So, and if he doesn't have faith, there is no question that he'll advance. So how do we do something that the person will develop a faith?
So, Yeah, you can't preach to the unfaithful. That's an offense to the holy name, right? Ninth offense. Huh? So what you can do for them is expose them without preaching directly. That is, you can give them prasad and or just be friendly to them and once in a while show them something that's related to Krishna. Color of Krishna. Form of Krishna, whatever. And just seeing that is good enough for them. Seeing anything, hearing something, a little bit. Hearing a kirtan or whatever. You don't have to say anything.
But sometimes they come and start asking questions.
If they ask questions, then you can answer them. It means they have a little curiosity. If they can't accept, fine. Huh? Then you give them something, prasada or something, whatever. And this is the only way they can develop if they're not favorable in the beginning. Once they're a little favorable, then you can talk a little more. Give more prasada. Talk a little more, give them a little more kirtan and prasada or whatever like that. Gravity. We can develop that way.
Guru, like certain things, they come and ask questions, you tell them, and then they start arguing. I got into a discussion with someone, and you know, he said, he got into argument, you know, you're supposed to, he said, you know, you will evolve with time. So you keep doing your simple activities, then you will evolve. You know, once you get tired, then you start evolving. And I was trying to, you know, tell him, no, this is not going to happen. But he started arguing, and then, you know, we got into a big argument.
Well, of course, it depends on your skill in arguing and whatever. Generally, it's better not to argue with people. If they want to argue, of course, you can give some points. But sometimes arguments are useless because people don't want to accept points which are valid anyway. So it's useless arguing with many people in this world. So in that case, better switch to something else, some other tactic than argumentation, because generally people aren't convinced by arguments unless they're very intelligent and they can, and the argument is based upon simply curiosity, not trying to defend themselves or whatever, or having preconceived notions of something or other. If they're open, fine, but if they argue, then it's better not to discuss. One of the angas of devotional services of it said, don't study many scriptures. I said, well, we don't need scriptures. So the warning there is, don't read scriptures and learn scriptures simply to argue. Simply to argue with others, that's not our goal. Why? Because arguing is for people who don't have faith. Right? And one of our other angas of devotional services, don't preach to the faithless persons. So for those people that don't have faith, better simply engage them somehow without their knowing in devotional service until they do become favorable. That's all.
Isn't it better to be remembered with faith for things that we do to get a higher taste and to give people a higher taste?
Yeah.
Prabhupada said that we shouldn't agitate people's mind, because if we agitate their mind, it doesn't give them a good
taste. Yeah. So we have to do it indirectly through some experience, otherwise you give them prasadam or something like that. Yeah.
There are lots of ways to speak of philosophy without directly mentioning Krishna, and some people you can talk to on what they think is a mental or intellectual platform. The minute you mention something spiritual, they then become very defensive.
Yes.
So people like that we can talk to without actually mentioning Krishna, we can give them the Krishna's philosophy. Yes? Without getting them too defensive.
But even then they may be very defensive and argue simply for their own sake of arguing whether it's spiritual or not spiritual. So that's kind of useless then, yeah. They can, if their intelligence is a little warped and they just want to argue for winning or whatever, then it's kind of useless.
Maharaj, in chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, it says that the disciplic succession was broken.
Mm-hmm.
And Prabhupada says that his disciplic succession goes all the way back to Lord Brahma. So, for someone who's skeptical, how do we resolve this apparent contradiction?
Of what?
In chapter 4 it says.
Oh, yeah, that disciplic succession was broken. And what saying, whose disciplic succession is not broken? Ours?
Yeah.
Or what? Or the Brahma Sampradaya, I mean?
Yeah. Some people say that it's a contradiction.
Oh, no, there's many Sampradayas, and some of them break and some of them continue, that's all. Huh? So that one is a particular Sampradaya. Huh? They came to the Sun God and Manu, etc. Swapu and Manu. and Vaibhasata, all that. But that obviously was one line of teaching. But there's many lines of teachings, and some of them get broken, and some of them remain. So now we consider four Vaishnava Sampradayas are there. So it's not just one, there's four. And some maybe died out also, others which are not, you know, we don't hear about now. So the many Sampradayas, some of which are still present, some of which have been broken. And even if it breaks at a certain point of time, then it can be revived again. As Krishna says, I'm speaking again this knowledge to you, Arjuna, after it was broken. So then we get another Sampradaya there. But then we'll have to go through Krishna to Arjuna, we can say Vyasadeva, etc. That way. And from Vyasadeva down. Rather than after it was broken again. But because it has an authoritative beginning with Krishna speaking to Arjuna, then it's authorized again. The nature of the material world takes a little break. So even the spiritual line gets broken because of the influence of time, whatever. So that's natural. But again, Supreme Lord will come, or someone will come to reestablish it. The devotee will come, or the Lord will come.
Maharaj, by Adhyas Sukriti, how person gets mercy from Krishna? You give them association, you give them prasadam, and you tell them about Krishna. How they get mercy?
This is a slow process. Since they're not doing anything by their own free will and enthusiasm and faith, it's a matter of no faith but no offense. So they get exposed to Krishna without knowing it, because they don't voluntarily seek out Krishna. So it's an involuntary process. So it is not as strong as having faith and then voluntarily by your free will learning about Krishna and worshipping Krishna. But it is also not useless, because it's related to Krishna. So it has some influence. Just like Nama Bas is has some influence, but pure name is better, more powerful. So the sun behind the clouds gives off light also, and we can still see in the daytime even with a cloudy sky. But if the clouds are not there, the sun is more powerful, we get more heat, etc., more light. So if we have obstacles in the way, in terms of impurities and other things, then the effect of bhakti is less. So if we have no faith, it's even less than that. Navabhas, we can have faith and still have, you know, partial effects because of ignorance, etc. But if we have no faith at all, then there's less influence. But it's not zero. So that's what the faithless people have to deal with. They get a little bit of effect from this Agyata Sukriti. So it'll take a long time, many, many, many births for them to develop to the level of faith. But there's no other alternative for them.
Mother Kunti is asking, trouble all the time to Lord Krishna, so that I can never forget you. Mother Kunti is praying to Lord Krishna, give us more and more problems, so she can always remember him.
So?
Mother Kunti.
Yeah. So what's your question now?
Just I'm asking the way how she is asking the prayers to give more trouble so that I can always remember.
Yeah, so that was the question?
So that's I'm asking the comment on this. Why Bharakuti is asking more and more
trouble? Well, of course, all of these personalities are Nityasiddha devotees. Pandavas and Kunti and all these personalities, they're not sadhana siddhas. But at the same time, they will express themselves out of humility and whatnot. And even Krishna himself says, you know, he acts like a normal person and worships and gets up early in the morning, meditates, etc., performs sacrifices like an ideal king. So they go through this, when they express themselves sometimes in this way, they will express themselves like normal people. And they will say, well, I have to somehow remember you. So when people are in trouble, then of course they call out to the Lord more than if they aren't in trouble. This is normally in the material world. When we're successful, then we go to the temple. When we're materially well off, then we don't go to the temple. So when we have that suffering, if we have a little faith, then we go, we depend on the Lord more. So this is basically what she is saying. But actually she's beyond that because she's a pure devotee. But she's expressing that sentiment of a lower level person, that's all.
Maharaj, in India, we see even now the female child is, in some parts of India, female child is not considered to be very important compared to male child, and some atrocities towards the ladies, which are seen as non-equality. Other day one lady was asking me, you know, even in your Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says ladies are less intelligent and things like that. So how do you
say that? Doesn't it? Where does Krishna say that?
This is Vaishya Sudra.
He says even Vaishyas and Sudras can attain the Supreme Lord. He doesn't say they're less intelligent there, huh? Does he?
This is in the Bhagavad
Gita. Oh, I see. Anyway, the verses would say so. Now, of course, in the Varnashram system, which is not pure bhakti, then we have classifications of people. Brahmins are higher, Kshatriyas are next, whatever. In a modern democracy, people will say this is horrible. Classify people as superior and inferior. Everybody's equal. That I can say. But here we say, no, these of us are better, more privileged. At the bottom, we have all the sudras, 90% sudras. The labor force. So to say that in the modern world is offensive also. Intelligent people are superior. Well, that's exactly what Varna Ashram is to do that. Even within each Varna, lower Sudra, higher Sudra, etc. Lower Kshatriya, higher Kshatriya. Even lower Brahmana, higher Brahmana. All that's there also. So the women are also put in there. And so we say women are inferior to men. Basically, all the women are down on the lowest level because the Brahmin women will be up with the Brahmins, more or less. Yeah? And the Brahmin women vary in the Brahmin families. So even among women, there's higher and lower also. So that's Varna Ashram system. There's classifications of people according to their qualities, occupations, etc. And within that, of course, there is also flexibility. We see that Krishna plays the role of Kshatriya, not a Brahmana. Doesn't mean he's inferior because of that. So ultimately these things are used as far as material designations for particular roles of working in this material world, having a job and supporting yourself, etc. They divide people up in this way, functionally. But spiritually speaking, we don't have to think of these things. Because the spirit soul is beyond the body. And then we have bodily attachment. To that degree, we have to fit within Varnashram system. The less attached you are to the body, the less you have to follow. So that you can ignore these designations, the higher you get in terms of bhakti. So you don't have to follow the Varnashram system, you don't have to see the differentiation of man and woman. But that's higher you go up. The lower you are, the more attachments you have, then the more you have to recognize those distinctions. So of course in the modern world, yes, they will say we're all equal, etc. And women are equal, and that women can be policemen, women can be army sergeants or whatever they want to be in the army. Generals, they have generals also, women generals now. So they can take any role they want to. Which is a relatively modern concept. It was even there in 1920, I don't think. They had to fight for the vote in 1920, I think, in America. Women didn't have the vote. Anywhere in the world until 1920 something, that some women got together and said, we're going to get votes. So up until then, it was different, completely different. Now, of course, everyone's equal. This may also be a passing phase. We don't know. Could be a passing phase. And it could go back to something else again. So this is just a modern theory that people have, or a concept. It may not be permanent, like any other concept. So Varnashram, they have a different concept. Everybody's classified. And women are put in there also in different categories. In any case, it doesn't mean that anybody gets exploited. So even the sudra should not be exploited. Yes, he does labor. He doesn't have money. He has to work for others, but he has to be perfected also. He has to be given everything that he needs for him and his family. So the government and the kshatriyas have to take care of that. It's a good life. Full social security, so to speak, you know? For all the laborers, it's nice. But you have to work. If you work, you do. If you don't work, no, nothing. Get out of the system. So it's a type of social system. We may not agree with it. But then, of course, this social system that the modern world has, is it perfect? Probably not. A lot of problems in it. A lot of unwanted persons doing all sorts of criminal activities or whatever. So it doesn't look perfect also. So to answer that, you can just say it's a different social system. And we cannot really argue on which is better, because we have enough problems with this one, so we can't say it's the best. Yeah? We look at the system, see the crime rates, this and that, all the illegitimate children and everything. We can say it's the best system. We can't. Can't say it's working nicely. If you say 20 years ago, maybe, there was less crime, less problems, less disease, less everything. Maybe it was a better system then. Or 40 years ago, 100 years ago, we don't know. So it's just a concept we have in the modern world. This is the best system. As far as Vaishnavas, of course, we don't care about all that, one says, because everybody, is the bhakti is also part of the jiva. Okay.